Trish, good to have you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It's only a few days until your next TED Talk. What's the topic going to be?
It's actually my second TED Talk, and this time around, I'm going to be talking about why the best rules for diets are no rules.
So why are there the best rules for diets, no rules? I like rules. Huh? I like principles more, so I'm not a big rule guy.
Personally, from experience, there are rules which are great, but a lot of the times there is also habitual change. So you could educate somebody to their ears, but if they're not prepared to change, and you know, I know you talk a lot about you don't coach motivation, right? But you need to have somebody who's already motivated or ready and prepared to make a change in order for them to absorb that information anyway. So I found that rules are great if you have someone that's 100% motivated. So if I have an athlete where I said, okay, you know, put a cat on your head, wear yellow knickers, and like eat cardboard, they do it. Right.
How many people are 100% motivated?
One.
if you get lucky.
Yeah, exactly. Then you have the rest of, you know, general population. So if I get an athlete, great. But 99% of the time I work with, you know, moms with three kids, professionals who are traveling around the world. They need to be ready to make a change. Otherwise, there's really nothing much that I can do in terms of like motivation, because I can encourage them and I can support them, but I can't intrinsically, if they don't have that motivation in them, it's really hard. So in a way, I try and teach them intuitive eating, right? So to actually go back to the basics and say, hey, you know, I ate this, I don't feel good. Then don't eat it.
That's a very good point.
Yeah. There's no point. And I also think that, you know, in today's world, we're about to be in this big revolution of omics, right? So you can track anything and everything. And there's more and more coming. If you look at the health tech scene, it's booming with, you know, new lab tests, new diagnostics, new trackers. I saw a Whoop band come out. There's so much. So soon people will stop actually having to think, and they're just relying on data. But how much of data is actually true and accurate, right? There's nothing more accurate than your body saying to you like, hey, stop this shit.
And how much of the data you actually use? If you consider the internet, at no point in history we had more access to data and knowledge than ever before, yet at no point in history people were that confused about one of the most basic things about eating. Right?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think a lot of people as well, you know, they're so easily influenced by documentaries that are sensational. You know, there's one particular one out there right now.
You've gotten a lot of questions lately about Game Changers, I move.
Yeah, I'm not, see, for me, I didn't have, you know, I just couldn't sit down and go, okay, I'm not going to type an essay. So I've just shared posts in that sense. But really, ultimately, right, if I don't give a whatever you are eating, as long as your biomarkers are great, you're healthy, you're fit, and you're lean, and you're happy. So, you know, if you're walking around with excess body fat, you're unhappy with yourself, and you know you're vegan and your biomarkers are gone to hell, then it doesn't matter what documentaries or books or people you follow, your nutrition approach is not working for you.
If it works, keep doing it. If it doesn't work, change.
Yeah, exactly.
As you know, I like data, and one of the most funny snippets on data I have on a vegan diet, it's less than 1% of the population that actually is on a vegan diet. Interesting, though, over 80% of people that are vegan for less than 1 year. So it's, you could, based on just raw data, you could argue it's more about a trend rather than a sophisticated and widespread nutritional solution or diet, if you want to call it like that.
Again, it's trends. I mean, if you look at the business of fitness, that alone, it's massive. The supplement industry, it's millions of dollars. You cannot make money from the basics, right? People don't like the truth. They like fads. They like trends. You know, they like something that's sensational. The harder for you to do it, you know, the more money they'd almost pay for it. But I guess that's human nature, and that's the power of marketing.
The hope for the new, the hope for the holy grail.
Yeah.
That which I think is the one thing that I, you know, I have no problem with health documentaries if you understand that it's basically just one point of view on one topic that's very, very targeted and narrow. So there's not going to be a nutritional documentary that's going to show things from two perspectives.
Yes.
You know, if this is about a vegan diet, it's just about the vegan diet. And yeah, for everybody that's interested, I haven't written an essay either. I also just forwarded posts and told people, like, Google. There's people that take a lot of time and they take the science behind, for example, Game Changers apart.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I have actually posted is the point that, you know, the whole trailer and the whole movie is based on the idea that gladiators, that there's a study that has shown that gladiators are lived on a vegan diet.
Yeah.
But if you look in more detail, it was no study. It was actually a journalist that has looked at the skull of a gladiator in a museum in Vienna, and based on the thickness of the bone, assumed that this gladiator must have been on a plant-based diet. And yes, there's some evidence, especially in the early days when the gladiators were mostly slaves and fighting.
And that part makes sense. It makes sense, you
know?
But also, when you look at it, meat is expensive, right? So it's cheaper to feed people that you would rather use as cannon fodder. Cheap shit.
Especially in our times, more than ever, right?
Yeah.
Considering the amount of people we have. And a lot of the other studies, if it goes too much in that direction of, okay, this is the thing, it's the only thing, and, you know,
It
works better than everything else. If you look at, for example, being a German, there's the one German guy in the documentary, the strong man.
Yeah.
I'm also, that's one thing that comes up, but the strong man. My point is like, you know, the strong man is the best German strong man, but internationally, it's like, you know, no offense to my friends from Liechtenstein, but it's like saying, I'm playing for the Liechtenstein soccer national team. It's like, good, but internationally, you're not qualifying for anything, right?
Yeah.
The German strongman is the best German strongman. It's actually, it used to be a bodybuilder, and then he put on 40 kilos of fat. So back in the day when he was a bodybuilder, he ate meat. Then he put on 40 kilos of fat, went vegan for some reason. He's been vegan forever, so he's been in the media in Germany before the whole vegan trend. And now he's obviously riding the wave. It's good for him.
Yeah.
But if you look at the most successful strongman in the last 30 years, how many of them have been vegan? So basically none, if you count the German guy, depending on how you count.
And then there's
successful
talent as well. There's your competitive pool. There's talent. There's so many other different factors. It's not because you're vegan, you know, you're a winner, right? There's psychology involved as well with when it comes to competition. So I think that people are, you know, tend to take things out of context. It's nice to be sensational, but in reality, you have to consider, okay, what works with your life? Right. Being vegan here in Hong Kong is quite hard. Right. So
how come?
So in Hong Kong, a lot of people live in very small apartments. There's not much of a culture of like cooking at home. So a lot of food is, you know, prepared outside, or you basically either take away or you eat out. Right. So you don't have control already over the quality of your food. And if you do, right, you're going to really good restaurants. Again, you're not, you know, no disrespect to any of the chefs here. And I know a few, and I know that they are, you know, they are very good with sourcing their food. But most of the time, a lot of the food's imported from China, and it is in a way mystery meat, right? So, you know, and vegetables, you don't know where they're coming from. You don't know what pesticides are being used. So it's, I mean, for me personally, I have found that my best results is when clients prepare food at home consistently, even if it's half the meals in the week, right? Eat out for dinners, because that's generally the culture. There's a lot of entertaining happening. It's actually, so let me say this. It, for the most part, it's actually cheaper to eat out than to cook at home.
Similar to the US, right?
I think so, yeah.
US, you can have a steak at a steakhouse chain.
Exactly.
And it's cheaper than buying a steak, buying broccoli, buying sweet potato, and making it yourself.
Exactly, yeah.
When speaking of China and food, we have a common friend from Singapore who is a Chinese guy. And years ago when he came to Stuttgart, he told me about this whole fake food thing in China.
Yeah.
Where they make fake rice from plastic.
Fake eggs. I think it was fake milk powder. I can't remember what else there's fake.
They made like dumplings that they filled with cardboard as a filling. So,
They found, this was a long time ago. This is, I think, when I first moved over here in 2009. They found a truck that had meat that was dry aged for 50 years.
Crazy.
Yeah, so it's down to regulation. It's also, I don't know what it is with Asia. I mean, I come from Australia originally, and there's a lot of stringent regulation and legislation, and there's a lot less so here. You know, whether it's corruption and whatnot. So yeah,
you probably have even more than Australia.
Yeah, exactly. And coming here, I never really thought about food quality so much. When I first moved here, the taste of chicken was very different to the taste of chicken back home. And that's when I started asking questions about, okay, what am I really eating? Where's my food coming from? And then you discover that, you know, it comes from somewhere in China, but they don't really have very much transparency around, you know, which farms, what they do with it, etc. And you can tell by the taste of things that are a little bit off. Just from two things, preparing food at home and focusing more on food quality, I get better results of my clients than telling them to eat, you know, 2,500 calories, looking at their macros, nutrient timing. I mean, I've been there, done that. It for them, it doesn't work. They've got busy days. They are in the office from 8 o'clock till sometimes 8 p.m., 9 p.m. Others work till 11. They travel. Most of my clients travel at least once a month, right? The majority of them travel actually probably up to a week in a month. They eat out 80% of the time, right? They generally reach for convenience foods because they don't have time in between their desks. They're not mindful about what they eat. So simply from saying to them, hey, take a step back. When you have your lunch, go for a 20-minute walk. Right? Just little things like that. You're getting them to add steps in their day. They're obviously training. And again, coming down to training, these guys are not training 5-6 times a week. You know, they're training twice, maybe three times, if I'm super freaking lucky, four times a week. But just simply by getting them to add more physical activity, change up their food quality and where they're getting their foods from trusted sources, you're getting body composition change, and they're actually feeling better and their biomarkers are better.
So the first thing you do is you emphasize food quality.
Absolutely. 100%.
Second after that, you go into food choice.
Food choices, particularly about, like, you know, just have on your plate vegetables, some meat, some seafood, and, you know, and carbs, but not they're pretty good with they're pretty good. I mean, there's no outside of, say, most of my clients are transitioned off bread, because here actually in Hong Kong a lot of bread is sweet. So people from overseas don't like it anyway, unless you get your hands on some pretty good, like, decent bread, but it's expensive again. And then I have the morning crews that go in and, they grab from Pret, they grab from Starbucks. So it's really about changing breakfast. And once I've changed breakfast, everything else kind of flows. So I've just found little tricks here and there. If you've had a crappy breakfast, you know, you've had a high sugar, high carb breakfast, you're immediately hungry by 10:30, 11, you're reaching for stuff, you know, you're going out for coffee, and then you go for coffee, and let me have that muffin, I feel crap, right? they have salad for lunch and with nothing in it, it's just green. Then they're hungry by 2 o'clock and then they're reaching, you know, they're going into their office pantry and going, ooh, what did someone bring back from Japan today? It's
raw fish.
Yeah,
unfortunately not.
And unfortunately not. It's generally cakes, cookies, you know, stuff like that. And yeah, so I guess if there's any rule I have, it's really make sure you have a good breakfast.
What's a classic Hong Kong breakfast?
Starbucks, Pret. Alternatively, congee.
So congee, with, like traditional Chinese soup.
Yeah, it's like a rice that's been cooked for a long time, and it's like gruel, with deep fried dough sticks that they kind of dunk in. It's great. Or alternative, you can get those dough sticks and they're covered in like a rice flour sheet that's been steamed. Hong Kong indigenously has like this, you know, British influence. It was previously a British colony. So there you can actually get, maybe you should try this, a macaroni soup with, it's like a tomato-based broth. So it's pretty much Campbell's tomato soup. Made into a broth, and they put macaroni and ham in it. That's also a classic Hong Kong
I've never breakfast. Even heard of that.
We can go. There's plenty of places that still serve that. Pineapple buns. It's not really pineapple. It's like a sweet bread that has what seems to be cookie dough put on top. Egg tarts is another one that's, I think, been imported.
A lot of grain sugar.
Oh, yeah.
Baked goods is...
Processed goods. Refined grains. It's not the best.
So when you change them to a protein and fat breakfast, what choices are there for eating out, right?
Meal prep.
So they have to make
they
it themselves.
They have to, yeah. There are actually a few good companies now that do meal prep ahead of time. So that's actually come out in the last, when did they all start? Since 2013, we've seen a rise in like the number of sort of healthy meal delivery companies. That's helped a little bit. It's mostly eggs though that they serve for breakfast. Yeah, I mean, it's really about, okay, guys, if you can just make a bunch of meat patties on a Sunday afternoon, right, get a good blender. It's going to take 15 minutes. Put it in your freezer, defrost them, put it in the pan. It's easy, right?
So breakfast they make at home?
And then lunch, generally, you do have... it depends on where you are in Hong Kong. In central, there's quite a lot of really good options these days. And dinner, it's again a little bit of education, you know. Leave the alcohol for the weekend, drink in moderation.
Progression over perfection.
Exactly. And it's slow. So I'm not a big fan of, well, these days it seems to be 6-week transformations. The traditional 12-week transformations, I'm not a big fan. I generally say to people, if there's anything that you transform in 12 weeks, it would be mindset. Because that is the glue that will start everything going the right way. And then you work from there.
How do you address the mindset component?
Ooh.
Well, let's start that way. Your first TED Talk was basically a mindset and grit. For those that don't know you, you're a personal trainer, nutritional coach, but you used to be a professional MMA fighter.
Yes, so I was Hong Kong's first female professional MMA fighter. That was when I was much younger, much leaner, and I didn't mind getting beaten up.
What weight class do you compete at?
Strawweight? I competed at welter. Yeah. No, not straw. Oh my God, I wish I could compete at straw. I started off at straw. Yeah. And then I was a little bit too light. I got tossed around by this Dutch girl. And my coach decided for me to actually go up a weight class, get stronger. First of all, get stronger, put on some muscle, go up a weight class. And I fared way better there. I actually started off with boxing. That's my first love. Picked up jiu-jitsu. then one afternoon in the gym, I was watching some of the guys wrestle. I didn't know what it was at the time. I knew about MMA, but didn't really know much about wrestling. And I asked if I could join and found out what it felt like to be in a washing machine. Loved it. Really what year loved was it? Wow. This would have been... I started... My first amateur fight was in 2009. I picked up jiu-jitsu, I think it was 2011. And then shortly after, just, you know, my first MMA fight was 2012. So it all kind of snowballed really quickly there. I love the sport. I mean, there's nothing, it's like chess, but physical, mental, it's the ultimate test. You know, you got to be on point with nutrition, you'd be on point with your training, you'd be strong, lean, fast. Like, I loved it. That was great. I learned a lot about mindset and grit through that. In a way, I do think I had it in me, though, with all that kind of stuff. I mean, just family-wise, I think there's probably no fighter there with, like, you know, that's clear personal issues. But I came from a, you know, pretty much broken up family. Sport was one of the ways, actually probably the only way, which I used to step away from all the stuff that was going on around me personally. And when I found martial arts, it just connected. Like, I'd done so many sports before that. I played netball, hockey. I was on, you know, I made it to state level swimming. I used to do, I somehow ran endurance somehow. I don't know how.
Just for the experience. I did too, as you probably know, right?
Yeah. I thought it'd be, you know, I really thought it would be an achievement to run 100 kilometers. I did that once and I'll never do that again. I much prefer 5-minute rounds, 3 rounds, maybe 5 if I'm lucky. That suits me
sets
more.
Sets of 3 reps.
Yep. That's exactly it. Don't mind sets of 3 reps. I don't like anything past 8. Prefer 3 to 5.
So your point was that basically the mindset, the base of the mindset has to be there. And then you
think
develop
so.
It and nourish it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think it's hard for people to naturally have it if they don't have it. Or there's something that's happened in their lives and they've somehow gotten through that, or they've seen what could happen and it's more of a reality check. You know, whether that's a health scare that's close to them or actually for them, whether it's, you know, some sort of trauma in the past. But it's something that, you know, motivation and mindset, something that is very, very hard for you to coach. You can only nurture it, you can guide it, you can support it, and you can grow it. But for someone to, you know, walk in and off the shelf buy mindset, not there. Yeah, hard. If you work it out, let me know.
I don't coach it, as you know. That's one reason why I don't. I am in the same boat. You know, it has to come from inside. Oh. Most people statistically will not make big changes. Usually, it's some sort of traumatic situation. If they make changes, or they got it in them. They're at one point where just like, okay, I'm like, I need to change.
Yeah.
And then they're like, okay, I'll do something different because I want that. Whereas most people, psychological factors. The trainability is just not there statistically.
Yeah.
And I've gone away from coaching psychological factors, motivation, commitment, compliance very early, because it's what I find a bit unfortunate is if you have a client that's committed and compliant, but it's not doing the right stuff. And in every single gym, there's dozens of people. They show up and they put in the work. Like every gym, I always say that is that one person, six days a week, 2 hours, 3 hours every single day.
Yeah.
They come in, they're committed and compliant. But they do like an hour of aerobics class, an hour of walking on the treadmill, and then they do an hour of weights with, like, you know, mint green dumbbells.
I have a guy at our gym that's exactly like that. And I remembered seeing him all the time. And you're going, that is such a waste. So one day I walked over to him and I said, hey, Sajan. He's going to love being actually mentioned on this podcast. This is Sajan. Do you mind if I help you? Right? It's not even been 5 months. He's totally changed. gut health, his skin, everything. He just decided out of, well, he'd been training for it for a little bit, but he did two of the longest Spartan races back to back over a weekend, wasn't tired out. I think he placed for his age group on both. Phenomenal. He's early 30s, I think. But I mean, he was doing, I remembered seeing him. So he'd do a class and then he would pick up more weights after this class and just do random stuff on it for another 2 hours. And you're like, man, you have actually just spent more time at the gym than I have in a week, you know? And that was his Saturday workout. And he was doing stuff, you know, at a commercial gym, just training by himself. And then I'm seeing on his Facebook that he's going out for these, you know, he joins this boot camp outdoors here. And he's doing all these, like, interval training, which is basically let's just hit it hard and be on the floor after. You know, it's not really scientific interval training. And he's doing this 6 days a week. When I asked him, how many times a week do you train? 6 days a week for a couple of hours each year, it doesn't match
almost
up.
No progress, right?
Exactly. And you know, he's one of those guys that's naturally very skinny, right? Over the last 5 months, his biceps are actually matching his you know, his training regime. And I think the biggest change is just that he just looks and feels so much better. He's always had gut issues. Not surprised, because he's practically overtraining, under recovering. His didn't know what to eat, wasn't on the right supplementation. So no, when you get a unicorn like that, you're like, okay, I'm gonna help you. It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what. And it's fantastic when you see that. But that's like my, you know, my one person.
But it's a classic example of someone who has commitment and compliance, but not the right direction yet. And some level of commitment and compliance, many people have, but then they can just channel it.
Yeah.
Or many that have commitment and compliance go to the gym 3 months, 6 months, and then they see like, okay, I'm going. But I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing based on the recommendations I got or what I think is right, but I actually get no results. Yeah. So I'm like, I'm dedicating my commitment and compliance to something else.
Exactly.
Whatever other hobby, flying drones or anything like that.
Interestingly enough, his motivation, I didn't have to teach him motivation, but his motivation came because his mother has cardiovascular issues. His father is also in the same boat. So he basically got into a gym. So he was overweight before. He got into gym because he wanted to prove a point, and he wanted to actually show them that, you know, just simply by being healthy, they can live longer and be more disease-free. So he already had that motivation and mindset to do it. Right? And that's the thing. And that's what I'm finding in, you know, all the years that I've been coaching, is that you could temporarily help someone, but ultimately, like you said, trainability, you know, they go back to what they're doing, which is why, again, I don't like 12-week transformation programs, because you rebound so quickly, you lost so much weight, and then all of a sudden you're back and you're back worse. Because Hong Kong-wise, you know, you've been here twice now, right? Environmentally, it's really difficult to get results. I mean, if you talk about leaning out legs here, it's tough without, you know, without
large
actually.
Large Asian city, toxicity. Yeah.
Toxicity levels are super high. You practically need to lock yourself up in an IR sauna every single day of the week if you really, really want to maintain lean legs. And so you're getting, so the one approach that for these 12, 16-week programs is to pretty much go low carb and low calorie.
And then
train a
metabolic
lot.
Metabolic training.
Yeah. And this is what I'm seeing. But then you get the result. You get the photo.
Some get the result. Some get the photo.
Yeah. But then you see them walking around a year later and you're like, you know, catfish much? Huh? So no, I really do think that over here, it's about food quality, is about managing stress. I've stopped saying minimizing stress, managing stress. and getting people to sleep. Hong Kong is the hardest city to sleep in. I sleep like a baby in Stuttgart. And when I'm here, so my flat is sort of close to the ground level. You're getting traffic in the morning. You're getting the, you know, the rubbish guy at like 4:30 a.m. yelling at somebody. I have this guy who recently acquired a Harley Davidson next door, you know, and he's an early morning person.
When I came here the first time, I had one stat. I don't remember it correctly. So if anybody's interested in it, really, Google it. But it was something like in Hong Kong, there is 7 people living per square meter.
Yeah. Wouldn't because be surprised.
It's building up.
It's so vertical. Everyone's living on top of each other. You know, if you sneeze on somebody, that's it. There's I read this morning that there's the pneumonic plague in China. So we're bracing for that now. Yes, we are. And on top of all the stuff that's happening right now. People get sick often and easily. I recently caught hand, foot, mouth disease off my baby, who caught it from another baby, who got it from another baby. So it spreads like this. It was probably the most effective way to lose 3 kilos in 1 week. Just by having...
It's not an official recommendation, right?
No. Oh my God, no. I could see food, but I couldn't eat it. It was the worst thing I've ever had. But people live on top of each other, and it's not good for stress levels. It's not good for anything, really. Whether it's staying healthy, staying free from, you know, your common flu. So that's why people get sick in an office, and all of a sudden it spreads like wildfire. So, no, I find that over here there's not that natural time out that people would usually have elsewhere. And again, I compare this to where I grew up in Sydney. You know, when I go overseas, I observe the people around me. In Germany, whether I was in Berlin, Frankfurt, or in Stuttgart, which is where I've seen... People are out and they're enjoying the sun when there's sun, but they seem to enjoy the outdoors and they seem to be able to exercise appreciation of beauty and excellence. Whereas over here, I find people are engrossed in electronics. They're looking at their phone most of the time. If you've ever taken MTR here and you just stop and take a check around you, everyone's buried in their phone. In the London Underground, you can't get reception, so you're forced to actually talk to people. So I think there are all these little things on a daily basis that add up, that cause an overload of stress and healthiness that people do have. And just really, you know, connection is a big thing when it comes to minimizing stress. People don't connect here. Everything's done via WhatsApp. You know, the less contact you have with people, the better. You don't, you know, there's not, you know, you don't wake up in the morning, you don't talk to the person next to you, right? Everyone's just avoiding each other. Now, the classic Hong Kong thing when I first moved here was, as you approach an elevator, in Australia, people hold the door open for you. In Hong Kong, they're pressing the button. Close, close, close. You just get an elevator in your face. You're like, what? What did I do? All right. So it's training and nutrition. There's also a little bit of lifestyle change that you often have to sit and slowly educate and slowly just make aware of. And then people are making these small little changes here and there. I always recommend my clients to spend at least the hour before bed away from electronics. When they wake up, and I'm the worst one, I do it, but when they wake up, for the very first thing they do is to not look at their phone. So it's the little things I find here, not the rules.
So instead of diet rules, create progressive habits.
Yeah.
I like that a lot, you know, because the one thing with rules is, they're just not flexible and they're just not adaptive. So yeah. when life changes, when times change, rules or when it comes to diet rules, they're just overboard rather than if you have habits, if you have principles, they're more adaptive, they're more flexible. If you're eating out, exactly. you know, basically if you have some animal plus some plant, you go to a Japanese place, you can have some wakame salad and some raw fish. You go to a steakhouse, you can have some spinach and a steak. You can go to a Chinese steak and you get a Chinese restaurant and you get some sort of a stir fry with meat and so on. So even if you go to an Italian, which often people, it's so much more than pasta and pizza, yeah. you get some veal, you get some fish, get some roasted vegetables with it.
Exactly. It's
fairly and easy.
I think there's too much reliance on, like, you know, how many people do you know, or when you look at social media or you're talking to others, they're like, oh yeah, so right now I'm on a keto intermittent fasting nutrition approach, and you're like, do you even know what you want? And how long have you been on it? Oh, a week, right? How's that worked out for you? It's really hard, but I'm enjoying it. I have great energy levels. Realistically,
it's for the first week or two, just because the amount of dopamine you produce as you do something new, and everybody tells you, intermittent fasting was the last thing that came up, and everybody was like, okay, basically breakfast canceling is a new thing. It's the solution for all health goals through nutrition is breakfast canceling, which is 16-8.
Yeah, exactly.
Nothing else
yeah.
than that. And the next thing, the whole vegan thing, it's coming up, and then the question is, what's the next thing after?
Exactly. But it's got to work. See, it's got to work for you. So if you're working, if I have a shift worker, right, and breakfast doesn't work for them because they're on call, they're working in a hospital, they can't be like, you know, they can't be there at 8 a.m. eating food, fine. Intermittent fasting approach would work because they naturally, and they have to do it anyway, right? If you travel to China a lot, yes, perhaps a vegetarian or vegan approach may do you better, given the fact that you don't know what you're eating when it comes to meat. It's safer to eat vegetables. Again, that's my experience and my opinion.
I've had clients travel to China, and after the first trip, we needed to adjust their nutrition to basically, they would eat breakfast in the hotel, they would eat dinner in the hotel. And for the rest of the day, we basically stayed on a liquid diet of amino acids. Okay. Rice protein, greens powder, and a little bit of protein bar, because just, you know, eating real meals throughout the day was for them. They tried it once and it was like, nope, I eat at a hotel. I'm not going to eat anywhere else.
My partner goes to a hotel in the middle of nowhere in China. And in the breakfast buffet, they try to translate what the breakfast items are. And there was some soupy thing. And the translation was the thing.
Did he ask what's in there?
He dared not. He just stuck to the eggs. and had a protein shake, you know, because you don't know what you're eating. So, yeah, I totally do that. But it's tough for the guys who live long term in China. But again, it's then again about importing the right produce and finding the right sources and suppliers. And that's a lot of what I focus on. I have a little black book. I recommend clients, okay, this website's great, this butcher's great, go to these places and you'll be safe. It's unfortunate, but you have to do it.
Progression or perfection is the big one with everybody. The rule thing, you know, the best diet rules or no rules. I really like that. Maybe could write a book about it.
I've been calling it the effort diet. A lot of my clients who know me very well, my friends that know me very well, they're like, yep, that's Trish's diet. Because I've followed rules in the past. I've done probably everything except for being a fruitarian and being vegan. Right? Actually, no, I did do vegan by accident for a month. I was doing the elimination diet where you could only eat vegetables and, you know, lightly poach it. And I felt great for a week and then felt horrible after. I couldn't lift anything. I couldn't move. I couldn't function. I even did the cabbage diet for a week, but it didn't work out for me.
As for everybody else, right?
So
good for experience, right? So I've tried a whole bunch of things. Actually, I went 5 months eating meat one time, But back then I was living in Spain, and I basically back then I just did it for budget reasons. It's much easier to live off of granola for breakfast and pasta for dinner than by me.
Again, there you go. It has to fit your lifestyle, right? And it has to fit, you know, it's got to be realistic. You know, if it's, I say to people, if it's not a, on a scale of 1 to 10, where one, I'm asking you to do Mission Impossible, jump off a cliff or whatever it is, right? And 10, where it's so easy that you think just by me asking you, it's stupid. It's got to be an 8, 9, and 10. Otherwise, they're not going to do it. They're not going to be compliant, and it's going to be a stretch. And as we know, whether it's, whether it's relationships, habits, doing things, anything that's a stretch for too long, you're not going to do it. I don't give relationship advice, by the way.
Yeah. 100% agree. If it's not easy, oh, that tastes good, I can eat that. It's often what I tell clients when we change breakfast, especially, is like, do you imagine eating that 2 years from now? And if it's something like smoked salmon is a classic one.
Yeah.
Some people love it for breakfast. Some people are like, fish for breakfast.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm not sure. And I'll do it. He's like, hey, Wolfgang said smoked salmon for breakfast is good. So I'm going to eat it. You know?
Yeah.
You're going to do that for a couple of weeks. Uh-huh. But then a few weeks down, you're like, no, I'm not going to eat smoked salmon again. I just have whatever piece of bread.
Yeah,
exactly. So I'm always like, hey, can you imagine eating that 2 years from now? And if it's like, I'm not sure, I'm like, let's move it out. Let's move something else in. And if something that we move in does not work for you anymore, just talk to me and we found different solutions. Because sustainability of change is
But there's large brainstorming involved.
The height of the change.
Yeah. But there's brainstorming involved. And that's really important. I find that a lot of coaches, they dictate. Right, there's no actual buy-in from the other party. So if I'm not buying into a solution, I'm not owning it. If I'm not owning it, I'm going to do it.
Right. If you're not believing it works,
yeah,
you it's not going to work. It's like there's this one study done in Canada with maids that make hotel rooms. You ever heard of that?
No.
I really like to quote that one. Because basically what they did, they took two groups of maids. The one group just did hotel rooms, clean, make beds, as before, and the other one, multiple times they get told that there's new research that has shown that making hotel beds is exercise, and they've been telling that to the maids over and over again, and I think it was a 10-week span, and they checked health markers and muscle mass, body fat, and so on, and the group that it was they were making hotel beds, whatever, 6-8 hours a day, there's no change in the actual activity. Yet they've been told that what you're doing is actual exercise. It's sport.
And they took it.
They increased muscle mass, they decreased body fat, and they improved health markers. Just from the approach of, okay, this is good for me. Which always, the other way around, if like, okay, I'm eating that pizza, pizza is going to make me fat. Huh?
Yeah, yes, exactly.
It's from a psychological standpoint. Wow. The other way around, obviously, if you just, the pizza is bad for you, but you still eat pizza every night and be like, oh, pizza is not going to make me fat. There's still a physiological factor next to the psychological factor. So I'm not telling anybody to eat shit food and convince yourself that it's good for you. But it's still the psychological aspect plays a huge role.
Yeah.
There's actually research done on strength training that has shown that visualizing a workout instead of actually doing it gives you about 50 to 60% of the strength gain.
Wow. Okay.
So if you put
that's a technique for fighters as well. I mean, I did a lot of visualization before I went in for a match, and you have to. You visualize from the time you're getting your hands wrapped till you're going in and you're ending the fight. I mean, visualization is such a powerful tool. It's one of the coaching tools that I actually use to help with motivation, to kind of delve into a client sometimes to almost find out their why. You know, why are you doing this? Generally people say, I want to get healthier. I want to get stronger. I always ask these days, I got it off, Doug, you'll meet him shortly. He does 10 reasons why you're here, which is fantastic because past 5 reasons, you're digging, you're really, really digging in. in the past, I've gone, okay, well, let's have a look at your historical timeline. So one of the things that I've been focusing a lot on the last 6 years is functional medicine. And from using that approach has helped me actually identify clients wise, because we actually run all the way back to the beginning of time. And I'm asking, okay, what happened here? What happened here? You know, how did you feel doing that? But where do you want to be? Right? What is your vision of health? But why do you want to do that? No, really, but why? Right? And in that sort of initial stages, you're getting it out of them. And in a way, you're also identifying clients that could work for you and those that could not, that are not prepared to change. So then you know which ones you're in given time constraints, you kind of know, okay, who can I really focus on and who could I refer on, or I could, you know, pass on, or who's the one that's going to be less compliant that I have to work a little bit more with if push comes to shove. So it's a good approach to find out why.
I've never heard of that approach, but
I really like it.
10 things why you're here.
Yeah.
And then just after the first, you got the classic one, probably like the first one, it's like, I'm going to lose 3 kilos.
Yeah, something but, like, but something why? Like that.
Yeah, something like that. Like, okay, but you know, technically you're, huh?
Yeah.
The most common goal that nobody talks about is just, you know, I want to feel better. Right? And nobody,
exactly, yeah.
I can't recall anybody telling me that at initial checkup. Usually it's like, I want to lose fat, gain muscle, or lose weight, yeah. Or no, that's the classic three,
yeah.
And maybe someone a bit specific if you have an athlete, like I need to get whatever faster, I need to get stronger, I need to get more flexible, mobile, and so on. But being the classic one, I just want to feel better. It's
if you're not
aware of what you actually want, it's a lot harder to actually achieve it. Speaking of functional medicine and you doing a lot of studying the last 6 years, you've learned from a lot of functional medicine doctors.
Yeah.
Same as I did. Which is the one where you say, like, this is the one that I resonated, that I enjoyed the most?
In terms of courses or in terms of, like, just
what they put out there? Topic, teaching, methodology?
I think in terms of teaching style, Owen Lacey, Dr. Eric Serrano, they have a way of putting things in such a way that it's very easy to understand, even though it's very complex. In terms of topics, I've recently been doing a little bit more on like inflammation, or rather inflammaging. So I think I'm just at that, you know, point in life, right? Like where I that's a consideration for me. Considering that you set the stage for aging in your 30s, right? So what you do in your 30s will have a huge impact for females, particularly in what happens in your 40s and beyond. So again, it's really about going, okay, well, I want to live a life that's healthy. And up until what point? Because a lot of the data and a lot of statistics look at, okay, what's longevity, right? So you're going, I think globally, we're looking at somewhere between 72, 76 years old. Hong Kong at the moment, interestingly enough, is between 82 to 86 years old. But I think we'll see that changing. China is a little bit lower. I think it's 69 to about 74 years old. Well, what is my disease-free longevity? And that's what people are not measuring. So I actually don't know up until, you know, so if I, let's just say I live till the average age of a Hong Kong person, female, 86 years old. But what is my disease-free age? I would like to stretch that as much as possible. So
life quality age ratio.
Yeah. I'm liking Dr. Sarah Gottfried's work. So I recently came from a lifestyle medicine conference in Taipei, heard her speak. A lot of what she was saying made sense. Alzheimer's and dementia and Parkinson's is a rising issue here in Hong Kong, particularly Hong Kong, China, and Asia. It's been called the third diabetes. And that's also very close to me. I have my grandmother's got Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. So it's, I've been looking a lot into blood sugar management, you know, with the continuous glucose monitoring. That's been such a powerful tool. Actually, it's one of the most powerful ones. Some diagnostics, oats is a good test to use, that I've been doing. And actually, the other thing would be fertility, interestingly enough. So I can't remember her name, Dr. Penny Thomas, I believe. Yeah, she's an American doctor, really works a lot on thyroid and I think she, and fertility. I might be getting the name wrong, but I'll probably get back to you on that one. But she's come in for a couple of like workshops here in Hong Kong, and I've been following a little bit of her work outside of that. So really a lot on women's health issues. Australia and Asia have the highest or rising infertility rates. IVF is a massive business here in Hong Kong, particularly in
IVF
Asia.
Is like artificial fertilization.
Yes. Yep. So women are finding it harder and harder to naturally get pregnant. Infertility rates in Australia, where I'm from, are rising through the roof. I think it's I think something like 40%. Infertility, it's really high, and it's to do with diet and lifestyle, right? You've got women who are diagnosed with, you know, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, PCOS, they're all estrogenic profiles, breast cancer is still rising. So these are all a function of, you know, perhaps what we're doing in the modern world. And it's, you know, it's something that I've been going, okay, you know what, that's a topic that I'm starting to become more and more passionate about. I've had a child, I've had miscarriages in the past, and it's interesting when you look as well at the psychology of like of getting pregnant, and the more you think about like wanting to get pregnant, the harder it becomes. I see this with my clients all the time. And IVF in itself, you're constantly thinking about it because you're on a cocktail of hormones, first of all. You know, you're not feeling yourself. And it's a stressful procedure. Here in Hong Kong, it's 80,000 Hong Kong dollars. So what would that be in euros? 8,000 euros? Per insemination.
It's almost divided by 10, basically.
Yeah, so per try, it's anywhere from 80,000 to 120,000 Hong Kong dollars to do IVF for one round. And legally, you must be married. Right, so if you're single, you can't do it. You have to go to Thailand, somewhere else. But it's expensive. And women are doing 4 rounds, 5 rounds, 6 rounds. So you can just imagine how much hormonal treatment they're undergoing at ages 38, 39, sometimes younger, 40s.
Is there any data that gives it an idea of why these rates of infertility are that high in Asia and Australia?
I'm not sure. I need to recall from the last conference that I went to in terms of data, but I do think that we in the modern world are becoming more stressed overall, where our agriculture is not where it is. It's very commercial. You know, we're exposed to a lot more toxicity in our lives. And whether it is, you know, through food or through chemicals, I have seen some studies to do with like makeup and heavy metals and things like that affecting fertility. Definitely anything that would affect menstrual cycle. So one of the things which I generally tell my female clients is that if you are not having a regular menstrual cycle, the chances are you're not ready for fat loss because your hormonal cycle is all out. So I'm dealing with all these other issues. Fat loss is a luxury, right? If my body has a hierarchy of needs, keeping you alive and working is going to be the highest priority, right? Losing fat may not necessarily be if you're walking around undernourished, right? Stressed out, as your sex hormones are all over the place. Your estrogen is going down, you know, that a really bad pathway. When I do, sometimes I run a Dutch test on them. It's, you're just making bad estrogen. You're not getting it out. Your detoxification is poor. You're not going to lose fat. Period. No pun intended.
Yeah. Hormonal balance is definitely a key point. And in an environment like here, especially when we talk infertility in Asia, my first guess would have been toxicity. Yeah, toxicity is not that much of a problem in Australia. To my knowledge, it's pesticides is a big one.
Yeah, glyphosate. Yeah. I can never pronounce that word. Say it fast three times.
Toxicity is a big one. Australia, a bit different than here in Asia, but I think Asia will catch up soon too, considering probably Asia is now toxicity and industry-wise where Europe has been like 50, 60 years ago.
And hang on, also, actually, it was Japan and Korea that had the lowest sex rates on top of that. So if you look at the big picture as a whole, and Hong Kong's actually pretty low on the list too. So people are busy making money, they're not having sex. So you're already, you know, you're already not doing it, right? And also I think people are choosing to have babies later in life, and then you're adding all that on top of it. So that could be it. I'm not sure, but when I looked at the stats, it was Korea, Japan, and Hong Kong. And people in China have a lot of sex.
A lot of people too, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I think it was 2 to 3 times a week in China, and it was less than once a week in Hong Kong. So, yeah.
It's a lot more rural places. So the high stress scenario, I have one client that has a fairly high stress job, and he once pointed out that he doesn't need sex because... life Fs him every day, which is a very good point. You know, stress and libido are inversely proportionate. No?
Yep.
If you live in a high stress scenario, Tokyo would be a scenario like that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Huge city. Hong Kong, definitely huge, overpopulated peninsula with a little bit of an island in front.
And you know, it's actually 70% national park.
Forest, yeah.
Right? Isn't that incredible?
When you drive here from airport, the first bit is like, wow, it's nice and green here. And then there's the first skyscraper. And then it's just for the next 20 minutes, it's into Hong Kong Island. It's just skyscraper, skyscraper, skyscraper.
But that's the problem in Hong Kong. Only 30% of Hong Kong is habitable. Right? Or that's what they're doing. And there's the conspiracy theory about, you know, our lack of rental regulations, et cetera, and that properties only, I think property prices are dictated only by a few monopoly families here. So, and it's, and part of it's the cause of the political unrest, but I'm not going to get into politics. I have a rule. No politics, no religion. But it is only 30% of the actual Hong Kong you can live in. So it's no surprise that people are right on top of each other. There's big size skyscrapers everywhere. There's a lot of commercial buildings and residential. You're struggling. I mean, you don't have houses here unless you're out at the peak or. Down the south side of you're out near China in the new territories, right? It's very hard to come by a house. Most people live in an apartment, and I believe the average size of the apartment is 185 square foot, which is not much bigger than the standard car park space.
Yeah, which is like 25 square meters roughly.
Yeah, which is scary. And those new, brand new apartments that are about 150 square foot, they're going for 4 million Hong Kong, 3 to 4 million Hong Kong dollars. So that's
almost half a million euro.
Yeah, very expensive car park space.
Yeah, I looked that up last time I was here too. The real estate pricing is ridiculously expensive. Insane. Like,
it's
far past the majority of European cities. The only two exceptions that I know of is London and Paris that are almost as high, but not as high. Everything else is much lower than it, which makes sense. There's a lot of people, very limited space. So you build high, but still, you know.
Yeah, I mean, some people live on level 70 here, which is, you know, for me, it's insane. I mean, I can't fathom that high. When I first moved here, I was like, okay, I can't live in one of those. I've got to be slightly closer to the ground with, you know, with a bit more green. So I've chosen to live a little bit away from things, but I have a better, I feel well. Past the very first apartment that I was put up in here for 3 months, that was enough for me. That they couldn't even fit a bed in the bedroom, like a proper queen bed. They could only put like a double, and it's a Asian double, so it's 1.5 person bed. The sofa was, if I sat on it, I thought I would break it, right? And I was a little bit lighter then. So yeah, I didn't have a wardrobe. The wardrobe was in the bathroom. So I was like, okay, I'm not living in the thick of things. I'll live a little bit further up the hill or away. And it's slightly better. You're still paying a premium for it, but it's a premium that I'm happy to pay for.
Living space is life quality.
Exactly,
and it's de-stressing, which again, in a high stress scenario, or high stress environment like a big city, like Hong Kong,
yeah,
just for the balance and adding a little bit of a yin to the yang, managing your stress better. Yeah.
There's a lot of yang. I mean, there's a lot of focus on yang. It's about, you know, work harder, play harder, you know, keep doing more. And I mean, maybe it's not even just Hong Kong, but it's a lot of what we see on social media. I'm on social media quite a fair bit, by accident, really. But I see a lot of that. You know, it's all dopamine. It's all about getting a dopamine hit. It's like, okay, I did this, yeah, win, right? I did more of that. I lifted. I this. You know, and people psychologically think, okay, if I work harder for longer, do things faster, I'm going to get a result. But actually, it's about balance. It comes back to what you said about yin and yang, right? For every yang thing that you do, you've got to do something yin, or you're just going to run yourself to the ground. And that's what I see a lot of people here do. Yeah,
I think one of the biggest misconceptions with training is that effort equals results, which is just not true at all. Like, I have a German article actually on it. I call it the illusion of hard training, because I often see this, especially with athletes, especially in fighting. It's like, yeah, I'm very good prepared. I trained very hard for this fight.
And
like,
yep.
But how hard you train is not, you know, how hard you try is not. It's a question of being able to make and execute decisions. And especially in any sport, you know, if you run extra miles and if you run with a weight vest and then you go play soccer and the other guy has not trained in weeks, but just a much better technical soccer player than you, you're not going to win.
Yeah.
You don't have a chance or in fighting, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
The classic brawler, which is just
versus
physical,
very technical person.
Head first, go in, chin down, and hit. And if there's a guy across you that's a much more technical fighter, he'll just let you come counter you. And there's many, many examples of that where people just like, okay, tough it out and you get caught. And the same thing in training, you know, just because it hurts, or just because you sweat, or just you got tired, does not equal getting progress.
Exactly.
Or just in nutrition being like, I'm so strict.
Yeah, like, okay, no, but it doesn't equate to that result. And one thing that I need to remind people here all the time is that you can only train as hard as you recover. Right? If you're not recovering, you can't train as hard. And whenever someone trains with me, there's a couple of questions I always make sure that, you know, in my head, I'm always asking them, like, you know, how much sleep did you get? Did you sleep well? Right? What was your sleep quality like? Did you actually sleep through the night, or did you wake up all the time? How are you feeling today in terms of energy? 1 to 10. 1, you're zapped. 10, you're going to bounce off the walls and you look like my 1-year-old. You know? Oh, yeah. If I can bottle that kind of energy and sell it, whoo! Well, and what did you eat today? Right? that's all those factors are going to determine how well they're training or how well they're dealing with the day. Because sometimes I get someone coming in and they're like, yeah, I've slept 3 hours, but you know, I'm going to hit it hard. You're like, you're not going to hit it hard, buddy.
In that case, your mindset's in your way.
Like, we're not hitting anything hard today except for, you know, you going home and sleeping. Because if you feel like shit and you're going to injure yourself. I'm not in the business of injuring people. That's not my style. But yeah, it's there's definitely needs to be focus on not so much doing more to get the result, but doing things smarter.
Yeah, 100% agree. Efficiency is king. Not harder, but smarter. Yeah. That's definitely, when it comes to nutrition and when it comes to training. But for most people, it's a huge mindset issue. It's just like effort equals results. It's ingrained, huh? And it's just not, statistically, it's just not a correct.
It's like that calories, calorie is king argument.
What's the calorie is king argument?
Oh, about you know, energy balances, yeah.
You know, my view on the calorie deficit, it's like, but anything, if you put it out there, just make it simple, make it catchy, yeah, and ideally make it in a way that it polarizes and people will talk about it.
It's not marketing.
Like, so for everybody that doesn't know my view on calorie deficit, it's not like it doesn't count. Oh. Calories matter. But number one, a calorie is not a calorie. Number two, the calorie is not the only thing that counts. So just being like, go for a calorie deficit and you're going to lose weight. If it was that easy, we both would not have a job.
Exactly. Exactly. But I've seen it. I've seen it debated. It's a good debate. But again, it comes back down to it's marketable, right? The basics, like what we've just discussed, they're not really marketable. Oh, eat well. Listen to your body. You know,
move a little,
manage your stress a little bit, go out and take a walk, you know, step away from the things that shouldn't matter, right? Chuck it in the fuck it bucket, right? It's not going to sell. Maybe the last one might, but.
But again, just because of the catchy name,
right? There you go. It's all about marketing. Yeah. Maybe I'll write a book on that one.
I think just because of the name, it fit perfectly to be one of these books at airports that you walk by, you see it, and you're like, I don't even look at what's about it, just like the title, I'm gonna get it.
I've not tried being an author yet, so I can, you know, I might as well. I've done everything from management consulting to cage fighting to being a stunt woman and being on some random Hong Kong reality TV show. I might as well try myself.
You were on a reality TV show?
You will never find it. I will.
I did not know. Yeah. What is it? The Real Housewives of Hong Kong?
I wish. It's actually called G1 Fight Club. And it was when MMA was legalized in Hong Kong. And they took, I think it was 8 little Hong Kong girls that were, sort of half famous. And they put them all in a cage and they had to fight each other. And so I was on it as the coach of these girls. The fights were real. So, and the training bits were actually filmed in the middle of the night. But the girls really did train. Like they full on. When I got them, they couldn't do a push up.
It sounds like The Ultimate Fighter.
Yes,
it's the most successful reality TV show of all time.
Yeah, it was the Hong Kong version of The Ultimate Fighter with like really hot little Asian girls. And you basically, it was all over Hong Kong. Like they had advertisements on buses, on trams. It was pretty much one of the most watched TV shows in Hong Kong in 2016, 2017.
No second season?
They did a second season. They did like a mini sort of third season as well, like some follow-on. It was a pretty awesome experience. I've never really had that before, but it was really cool to watch like girls who literally, like when I got them, I had these clipboards, and you know, they gave you their sort of stage name, their height, weight, and all of that, and experience. And there was only one girl that was an athlete and could actually do push-ups. The rest just started off with zero. And by the end of it, we had, you know, we had a great upkick shot. So this chick got, like, upkicked. It was awesome. The other girls hated her for the rest of the season because it was illegal.
So the fighting was mixed martial arts?
Yeah, the fighting was mixed martial arts. Small gloves. Isn't that amazing? Okay. Yeah, they had shin guards at one stage, and they had the sort of the training gloves. But I mean, there were some good
elbows
injuries.
Elbows and knees allowed?
No elbows, knees were allowed. Upkicks were technically not allowed, but then it became one of the opening real shots, you know, because this girl kicked up and you could see the this other chick's head snap back. Right. It was fantastic. Producers were freaking out, because at the start, also what was amazing was they were like, is there a way for them to fight but they don't get injured? And I looked at the guy and I went, like, what do you want? Like, you know, do you want them to actually fight, or do you want me to coordinate a fight?
And even if it's coordinated like wrestling, there's still quite a bit of injury, right?
No? Yeah, exactly. But they ended up actually fighting each other. And I think when the second season came along, they had a few girls with experience, and that made it even more fun.
Yeah. So the ones with the experience just ran through the other ones.
Yeah, it was good.
That's a good one. I had no clue.
Yeah. It was 2016, 2017. They even had Jake Shields on one of the episodes.
For all the listeners that don't know, Jake Shields used to compete in the UFC and actually competed for welterweight championship.
Yeah, he was hot until successful. I found out he was vegan.
interestingly, the Jake Shields group, they're often promoted as vegan, but if you actually listen to what they do, they eat eggs, they eat fish. Yeah. So they eat a dominant plant-based diet, no? But they eat fish. They eat, no? One of his more known training partners these days is Nate Diaz. So, but those guys are actually, from what they say themselves, is they have some fish. They have some. No? So it's not just straight up vegan, but a plant-dominated
diet.
Diet.
Yeah. Yeah, so he was on one of the episodes. I was in makeup and I was like, oh my God, is that who I think it is? And like right next to me. And I'm going, oh, what do I say to him? And it was funny, the girl doing my makeup, she was like, why are you hyperventilating? She asked me in Cantonese, she's like, why are you so excited? And I was like, well, you know, he's a really famous fighter. And she's like, who? I was like, well, if you kind of think, and I mentioned the name of this, you know, celebrity singer in Hong Kong, and she was like, oh my God. And all of a sudden she was like, can I have your autograph? And I was like, oh! I was like, excuse me. So it was a good show. Actually, some of the girls are still doing jiu-jitsu. Yeah, some of them still doing Muay Thai.
That's interesting. So, here in Hong Kong, when I came here two years ago, the grappling and fighting scene is fairly big here, or recreational grappling, especially the gym I taught at last time. They had actually a wrestling class, like not wrestling, like
show. Yeah, Warrior. Like, yeah, my gym. Yeah.
Wrestling. Yeah,
yeah. There was
a lot of jiu-jitsu. Yeah. And there was this other MMA gym, which was like the biggest gym ever.
Oh, they shut down. They did. Yeah, it was too big.
I don't remember the exact size in square meters, but it was like a ridiculous size with everything. Boxing.
The rumor was that jiu-jitsu. They were paying $1 million in rent every month. So that's
in Hong Kong dollars.
Yeah,
so
that's probably why.
That's actually the same thing I heard, that the rent was six digits in euro.
Yep.
So it was just like.
It wasn't going to work. No. Yeah. But no, it's been a growing scene. When I first started in 2009, there was maybe two gyms, three that had mixed martial arts. There's a lot. So historically in Hong Kong, there's a lot of Muay Thai. So most of the fighters have a Muay Thai background. Taekwondo, So taekwondo is something that, you know, they do from kids, school, etc. So they did have this. Jiu-jitsu came later. And ever since then, there's been an influx of black belts coming in to teach and open up schools. Boxing's been pretty steady. Wrestling's still very new. There's maybe one other place that does wrestling, and there's one school that actually has a wrestling program. Okay. Yeah, an international school that has a wrestling program. So that's interesting, and hopefully that will grow over time. But yeah, the roots are really in Muay Thai here. There's a lot of Muay Thai competitors, a lot of Muay Thai fighters. The scene is quite big, and that's where it all kind of started. So MMA is still relatively new. There's actually more MMA in China than there is in Hong Kong.
Yeah, the Chinese, they have now like performance centers. The UFC opened up a huge place in Shanghai, if I remember correct.
Yes, there is, yeah.
And it's a lot of a lot of them coming out of, you know, it's a huge talent pool. Yeah. If you look at all athletics, right, if you look at weightlifting, if you look at gymnastics, if you look at even sprinting, like there's no Chinese sprinter that's like 9 point fast on 100 meters, yet the Chinese medal at world championships in the relay. So they got a bunch of guys that can run 10 point something. Huh?
Yeah.
They actually beat the German 100-meter team.
There's a fantastic Hong Kong female fighter that got accepted into the Performance Institute in Shanghai. So she's doing really well, carrying the flag. Yeah, so that's good to see that it's growing in Asia as well.
Especially these performance centers, they're for different sports. Yeah. There's some for soccer. It's just for the development of the youth athlete, not just to be more focused on it, but also to have better coaching and have a better training environment. We especially see that in Germany with soccer, many of the young guys come from their teams where they're basically the stars, they run through everybody, and then they get into these developmental schools and developmental teams, and all of a sudden it's like it's just a team of guys that used to run through everybody at their teams, and all of a sudden the level of competitiveness is much, much greater, and that basically elevates the whole game.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's great to see that they're putting money and sponsorship into sport here, because it's still a very, from the ground up, it's still a very society that's focused only on education, only on study. So, you know, for those of you who don't know, Hong Kong and China, actually even Singapore, have the hardest curriculums to get into. So schools will have massive waiting lists. You put your child on a waiting list when you're pregnant. That's how competitive it is, and it's expensive because you need to pay upfront debentures. There's multiple interviews. So, you know, right now, my child's 15 months old. I've been told that she's too late to apply to certain schools for pre-kindergarten, and even for nursery, there was no need for an interview. That's what I got told very nicely. But for pre-kindergarten, so 3 years old, she would need to attend an interview. This is highly competitive.
Preparing early for job interviews later, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to make sure my three-year-old knows how to answer the question of, you know, so where do you see yourself in 10 years' time? But it's very, very competitive, and they're completely focused on obtaining certifications, which is actually why certificates for attendance is very important here. There's a lot of emphasis on that, but it's mostly in the music and arts and extracurricular stuff that's not to do with sport. And then obviously there's the studies, so you have to be a straight A student, you know, that does all these things, including volunteer work. And it's highly competitive here. So you can just imagine, and you extrapolate that to young adults, you can just see where the stress comes from.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of competitive environments, because the easiest way to become a good competitor is to compete. Yet, definitely, if the competitive aspect becomes a stress factor too early.
Yeah. It's we have the highest suicide rate for under 15s. yep, in, I think, globally. There is, I think, the statistic, and I think it was 80% of under 15-year-olds have had depression or depressive symptoms.
Nutrition might play a role. Gut microbiome might play a role. Toxicity might play a role.
Interviews at three-year-old.
Over-competitive environment in the sense of interviewing a three-year-old. It's a long topic, and I don't have any kids, so I'm not there yet. But I know some, like, they play soccer and they don't keep score, which I think it's, come on, like,
yeah.
Everybody that plays keeps score. Like, you count goals. It's like, you know, yeah. It's important to win. As a three-year-old.
Yeah, absolutely.
But at the same time, I think, you know, competitiveness in the sense of understanding, okay, it's okay to lose. Yeah. And it's not okay to lose, but it's okay to lose. Learn from why you have lost and then get better and then win.
Yeah.
That makes it a much more a bit, I think, you know, winning is fairly easy. Even if you go back to athletes, winning is not that hard. Oh. But losing is very hard. And most... especially in very good athletes or the ones that get sorted out early, they don't learn how to lose. You need to learn how to lose because everybody loses. Even if you're whatever undefeated, you've been beaten up in training.
Yeah,
100%. If it's just been early, but the aspect of learning how to lose, it's more important as far as growing and getting better. Than always just winning. Yeah. You know, it's like the guy that plays soccer in his team and doesn't want to leave the team because he knows in that team he's going to score an average of 5 goals per game. Yeah. And he doesn't want to move up in another league because he knows he's not going to score that many.
Yeah.
That many.
But it's a cultural thing not to lose faith as well. So there's that whole thing, you know, there's a lot of fear of failing. You don't speak up unless you're 100% correct. It's very Chinese to do so. So a lot of times when I do workshops or seminars, even with coaches, when you've probably experienced this as well, when you say, does anyone have a question? It's dead silence. But then if you say to them, I'm going to hang around for another 15 minutes.
Or just, it's same night you get an email, but it's like, I have 3 more questions left. So like, just ask it that, you know?
Yeah.
I always tell, like, I've started this a while ago, and I always tell them, hey, if you have a question, ask a question, because at least one other person in this room will not know the answer.
Yeah.
And usually most questions, at least 90% of the other people in the room don't know. Yeah. There's no such thing as a stupid question. I'd rather answer one question too much or one question for the second time than not answering one question.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, yeah. It's something here that I do hope that it changes, you know, to be able to speak up and say, you know what, I don't know, but it's okay. Yeah, but
that's, again, it's a mindset point. You know, some people don't fear asking questions. You know, when I... 10 years ago, did a lot of traveling for first seminars. I myself asked as many questions as the whole rest of the group together. But, you know, asking questions, you learn.
Yeah.
So exactly. It's not a bad thing. There were still some people that be like, okay, rather than just sit from the outside and just listen. Whereas some, if you have a question, ask it. And you learn from it.
Yeah.
Ask good questions, you get good answers. Ask specific questions, you get specific answers. There's another thing with... many are like, I had this question, but it didn't get answered because you didn't ask it, right?
You're like,
you need to, if you want to learn, ask questions. It's one of the easiest ways, right? To learn.
Oh, absolutely.
Ask questions, and if you want to get more precise answers, you need to question more precise.
Very true. But I think a lot of people, sometimes when they ask questions, they're looking for the Holy Grail.
And then they're disappointed, no? But I think that's another thing, you know. You grow up and you know, everybody has belief that there's such a thing as a Santa Claus or Easter Bunny. We've all been there. And then you're like, okay, it's not the same thing as everybody who's is into training and nutrition for a while realizes there's not the one diet. There's not the one training program.
Maybe that's your next book. There is no Holy Grail.
There's no Holy Grail. It's not catchy enough. But yeah. And it's probably not, it probably won't sell. Because it's not entertaining enough than making
that's true. That's true.
The effort diet.
Yeah, unfortunately, that would
be much more.
Or maybe just call it the Holy Grail and talk about how there isn't a Holy Grail.
There's no Holy Grail. Yeah, actually, my third German book, it's called The Perfect Squat, and the first page of the book, I explained that there's no such thing as a perfect squat. So that could be.
There you go. There is a Holy Grail, guys.
That could be.
But not really. That could be it. Yeah.
Cool. Trish, I think a few people are waiting for us at dinner.
Oh yeah,
I think we're a bit late.
That's okay. They'll live.
Anything you wanna add?
No, that's it.
I think that's been a good
conversation. Diet rules, great,
and mindset.
Yeah, fantastic.
It's great. Thank you for coming
Thank
on.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's the first ever English one, and it's actually the first ever podcast with a mobile setup that's not recorded in my little podcast studio at the YPSI. So
fantastic.
Looking forward. Great. It's my first night in Hong Kong. We have three more days.
Yep. Yeah.
Thank you for having me over.
There's some reservatrol waiting for you.
I'm looking forward to that. And thanks to everybody for listening and everybody for watching. Great. For those Thank that you. Are watching, we're in the 41st floor overlooking Hong Kong Harbor, which is a pretty nice view.
Yes.
Don't see that much except lights because it's gone dark, but...
Yeah, no, it's one of the nicest hotels here. So well done on your choice. It's fantastic rates at the moment, so it's a great time to come over for bargain hotel. And actually, I think bargain flights.
Yeah, easy to get over. I did a little searching last time. I stayed on the other side of in Kowloon. That was a bit of getting through a tunnel. That took a bit of time. So this time I was like, hey, I'll stay on Hong Kong Island this time.
And you're stepping right into one of the moments of history of Hong Kong.
Yeah, it's been rough times here.
Yeah.
But we'll get around it.
Oh, it'll be okay. They'll realize that hopefully same time next year it'll be all over.
Cool. Trish.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Wolf.